It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The opioid crisis has had a devastating effect on the health of thousands and thousands of Pennsylvanians. But addiction can also place a heavy stress on family and other personal relationships. Joining me in studio is Nancy Wood, founder of Families Turning, which works to build and strengthen those relationships. Nancy, welcome to the Confluence.
Well, thank you, Kevin.
Nancy, your background, paramedic, nurse, social worker, counselor, sounds like a perfect resume for this kind of work. But Families Turning started out with what in terms of building, repairing, helping in relationships?
Well, I started when I became a therapist. I developed a workshop. I started in established communities, like religious communities, running this workshop and started going down into the panhandle of West Virginia, working down there. And I was running it in the Allegheny County Jail for a couple of years. And I started identifying specific families that were very empowered and encouraged by the skills and tools. So the family members of individuals facing addiction. The other thing that I noticed as I was going along, because I was doing a continuing education class, is specific professionals, individuals right. working in with addiction. Those professionals also were very, very empowered and interested in the relationship. So that's how we started. And then for over the last 2 years, we've been working with the family members of individuals facing addiction, and then also the recovery professionals of individuals facing addiction.
Are there different stressors on people that need help with their family relationships that are not really related to addiction, and those families that maybe are even torn apart a bit by the addiction, the struggles that a loved one has with an addiction?
Absolutely. There's not a lot of support for them. There's not a lot of spaces for them. You know, we work in conjunction with other programs like Al-Anon. This is just a different space to come and be able to learn about relationships and addiction in a supportive environment. It's really a place to learn and talk. One of the things often family members will tell me is that, you know, they're just told that they're supposed to kick them out, and the thing is that they love these individuals. And often, even if that individual has damaged them or hurt them, they're trying to figure out how to love them in the middle of this chaos.
So tough love, kicking them out.
Very hard, right?
Yeah.
Right?
You don't want to let go. You don't want to give up.
No. And the thing is, you know, it's an instinctual love, right? This is they want to help. This is someone like their child or someone that they've really loved. And the example that I often give is it's like a burning house, right? So an individual's in a burning house. And what are you going to do, especially if it's somebody that you love? Well, you're going to run in and get them, right? And you're going to get them out of the fire. The thing is, then the minute you turn your head, they're back in the house again. And you're like, what are they doing back in there? And they keep ending up back in this house. So one of the things that we really work a lot with is helping individuals figure out how to have boundaries while still loving the individual.
Right. You mentioned space a couple of times. Are you talking physical space or something else?
Both. I'm talking both. There's a physical space where we come together, and then it's a space where you can be vulnerable and share. You know, keeping relationships real, that's the initiative that we have. And that is a workshop where individuals come together. We have addiction professionals, the certified recovery specialists, and these are individuals that, like I said, are the foot soldiers of the recovery world. They really are these professionals that know a lot about the recovery world. And then the family members come together, and then I teach the relationship component. So there's a relationship professional and a addiction professional there, learning the information and then having the space to process it. And the physical space, the emotional space, the vulnerable space.
What is your message to, quote, the other professionals, the treatment experts and others about, okay, it goes beyond just the physical needs, that there are emotional needs, there are relationships, because, as you said, they're on the front lines. What's your advice to those other professionals?
The thing is that all of us need the space to be able to share the pain, because we wouldn't do this work if we didn't really care about these individuals. But boundaries Boundaries.
What do you mean?
Well, boundaries are really important because one of the most important things we have to do, just like that burning house I was talking about, at Keeping Relationships Real, we really learn how to be able to watch that and strengthen ourselves in the middle of watching that. We have to be strong in our me in order to strengthen our we, which is the relationships around us.
Are the boundaries between the treatment professionals and others and the individual who's addicted, or is the boundary between the family member and their loved one who is struggling with drugs?
Yes. Yes and yes. We all need boundaries.
Our guest on The Confluence is Nancy Wood, founder of Families Turning. We're talking about repairing family and personal relationships affected by addiction. How do you reach out to those families, to those individuals who are concerned about their relationships with those who are using drugs? How do you make it known that we're here, we can help you?
That is the hard part, right? Because the stigma is very difficult. And often individuals say they get their loved one maybe into a facility or something, and then they just go home and shut their door because there's so much shame and stigma. We're trying hard. We get to meet people like Kevin and be on The Confluence and talk about it. We really want family members to know that we are here to support them.
How do you confront that? If you do get to them and they're hesitant even and say, I'm so ashamed. And it's like, it's their fault, even though it's not their fault. How do you confront that idea of shame and trying to get rid of that so that you can build that relationship?
That's one of the first things we talk about. It's not their fault. Society does tell them that. You're right. Over and over again, they are told the message, I'm a bad parent, or I didn't do this right, or I'm in a bad family. So the big thing is that as a family member, they did not cause it, they cannot cure it, and they cannot control it.
So what can they do?
They can come and support themselves. The most important relationship is your relationship with yourself.
Mm-hmm. The workshops, are they for multiple people, not just these family members and their relationship with this individual who's struggling with addiction, but are there lots of different family members of different users?
Let me clarify that. It's only for the family members of individuals facing addiction.
But is it a, quote, one-on-one, you with the family of the user, or is it you, your workshops, you with multiple families and different users? So it's a lot of people at the same time.
That is correct. It's a lot of people at the same time, but there's always space, small spaces to share more intimately. And we make sure of that, that there's always a connection so that you feel like you can share more vulnerable things if you want to. You don't have to, but the skills are really key. We've had individuals who have come for a couple of sessions and they come and tell us stories like, your workshop jumped right off the page. So it's very powerful.
How important is that where one family member or one family can actually interact with another family going through a similar experience with their own loved one? It's like, I'm not alone.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You're not alone. And that really is the key at Keeping Relationships Real. That's the initiative that we're doing here because we want it to be real and we want it to be able to have a real community to talk about the real stuff in life.
Mm-hmm. What's the overall message you're trying to impart on these families?
Relationships are messy. Now, that's a fact, and we're going to start from there. So I'm here to journey with individuals. That's really my goal. So that, and this particular initiative of the addiction epidemic has just been so powerful to be a part of.
Mm-hmm. How do you measure, how do you assess the effectiveness of the workshops?
Well, one of the things is just what people have been telling us. We have some other ways that we've been doing it. We've worked with some researcher, a family researcher out of West Virginia. But specifically with the workshops for the family members, more than anything, it's the continuing comments and the empowerment that we see.
And finally, what do you say to the family that's, you know, throwing up their arms saying, I don't know what to do?
Come be with us. This is what we do. Keeping Relationships Real at Families Turning is really about being with individuals so that they can learn more and understand that they are doing a lot with what they're already doing.
Nancy Wood is the founder of Families Turning. Thanks so much for making the time.
Thank you.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. Pittsburgh area Congressman Connor Lamb visited U.S. troops in Afghanistan last week. We'll talk to him about the president's call for renewed talks with the Taliban. Then, a look at the history of Bruno Island and the Ohio River. Plus, a new exhibit featuring 50 of the greatest natural wildlife photos by National Geographic is in Pittsburgh. You can find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of the show on our website at wesa.fm/confluence. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
To call Frank Zappa prolific would be a massive understatement. He released 62 albums while he was alive, and the Zappa Family Trust has given us more than 50 since his passing. Born Frank Vincent Zappa, not Francis, in December 1940, Zappa was a guitarist, singer, songwriter, bandleader, and provocateur, not to mention his political activism. He railed against the government, organized religion, and censorship, often through music, but sometimes in court. Frank Zappa passed away 26 years ago this week after losing his battle with prostate cancer. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Last month, three candidates who ran for Franklin Park Council over concerns about fracking in their community pulled off upset victories. Were the results an aberration or a signal that fracking might be a key issue in state legislative races in 2020? Chris Potter is the editor of WESA's Government and Accountability Team. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Kevin.
Chris, for those who missed your reporting over the holiday, remind us, how important of an issue was fracking in Franklin Park to these elections?
Yeah, it was a big deal. It was the issue that kind of mobilized this slate of Democratic candidates. There were four who ran, and it started about a year ago when there was a proposal put before the Franklin Park Borough Council to allow a drilling pad in the municipality next door to drill for natural gas underneath a big 80-acre park they have there. And folks turned out for these meetings in large numbers to complain, and the existing Borough Council kind of took a step back and delayed its decisions and started to kind of rethink this whole thing. But at that point, there was this sort of groundswell on the part of Democrats, who are kind of minority in Franklin Park, to go ahead and run. And they ran a really strong grassroots campaign and did win three out of four of those races.
And Democratic candidates, as you allude to, don't usually do too well in Franklin Park.
Yeah, this is kind of one of those ex-urban. It's a very prosperous community, big homes right next to state game lands here. This is part of Mike Terzai's district, mm-hmm. The state Speaker of the State House. For Democrats to do this, a lot of people took notice of that result.
So this was one very local election. What about the issue itself? Is fracking affecting votes elsewhere?
Yeah, I mean, obviously fracking is a huge economic factor here in western Pennsylvania. And it's the nature of this industry, because the well pads are kind of scattered out and because there are pipelines being built. For a lot of years, as fracking was kind of coming up in Pennsylvania, it was a rural issue. Nobody really had to think about it in places like Allegheny. But now it's starting to encroach on places like Franklin Borough or other communities that are more densely populated. And so, yeah, it is becoming an issue that people are thinking about. The big question is, does a local issue like this, which is really kind of a not in my backyard issue, does that necessarily translate up the scale past the local zoning level or whatever? And I think that's a big question in a lot of people's minds going forward into 2020.
Right. Next year, the smallest, if you would, most local races are state house contests, about 60,000 constituents per district. That's usually spread out over some different municipalities. Any candidates sounding off on this issue yet?
Yeah, so a couple things. One is, yes, there have been some candidates already. Summer Lee, Sarah Innamorato, who were progressive candidates who won in 2018, who took strong positions critical of the industry. It's also a presidential issue, of course. You've got some Democrats, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, who favor moratoriums or outright bans on fracking. And then you've got kind of candidates who are closer to the industry, like a Joe Biden or an Amy Klobuchar. So this is an issue that kind of percolates up and down the ticket and will continue to do so in 2020. That's the big question for Democrats. Can we take a position here that pleases environmentalists without antagonizing labor and rural white working class voters?
Any pushback? Are we seeing any from people who support the gas industry?
Yeah, so this is a story we reported yesterday. Summer Lee, who I just mentioned, is likely to face a primary challenge next year from a guy named Chris Rowland, whose brother is actually in government relations, a lobbyist essentially for People's Gas, and is likely to get support from the building trades unions and other folks who have a stake in working on those kinds of jobs.
So is it fair to say Democrats are not of one mind on this issue when it comes to the elections next year?
It's very fair to say that. And one of the reasons that the Franklin Park story interested me was because there's been a take, especially since Mayor Bill Peduto made some remarks about the industry a few weeks ago, that there's a tendency to see fracking as an industry that really divides Democrats. But it cuts both ways. It's an issue where even in a staunchly Republican neighborhood, you can appeal to voters with their own concerns about this industry. And a lot of those concerns, polls show, have been growing over time rather than diminishing.
Before you go, Chris, we learned late yesterday that several Democratic presidential candidates will be coming to Pittsburgh next week to talk education. Who's coming and why that topic?
So, yeah, they don't have the final list yet, but there are at least seven that I can think of, including the top tier candidates. So Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Joe Biden have all committed, as I understand it, from the organizers to come to this. It's education because this is a big issue for Democrats, and it's here in part because Pittsburgh has a very active education activism community. The local chapter of the PFT has been very politically active here and is part of one of the key unions that make up the Democratic constituency, which is the teachers' unions.
Do we know the format yet? Traditional debate?
It's supposed to be, my understanding is it's going to be a mix of a forum where the candidates come up and speak to their own issues and have kind of one-on-one time with the audience, and then also a debate where the candidates will be together. But I'm not fully conversant with all the details of it yet.
Right. And you mentioned sort of why Pittsburgh, because education is a big issue here. Has education, though, really been getting much play in the national debate so far?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I haven't seen as much as other issues, but Elizabeth Warren, for example, just yesterday, I think, came out with a policy position on Title I funding for poorer schools and things like that. So I think it's going to percolate up. And again, this is a key Democratic constituency.
And very briefly, what should Pittsburghers be listening for and can they attend?
No, it's apparently filled up with teachers, unions, and activists and people like that. But it'll be interesting to see kind of what they have to say, and hopefully we'll be there to cover it.
Chris Potter is the editor of WESA's Government Accountability Team. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Congressman Connor Lamb visited U.S. troops in Afghanistan over Thanksgiving. The Western Pennsylvania Democrat talked with 90.5 WESA's Lucy Perkins about President Trump's foreign policy. They also spoke about the president's decision to pardon three soldiers who were accused of or convicted of war crimes. But first, Lamb applauded military efforts to combat ISIS.
The part of the war that's against the Taliban is a stalemate and is difficult for us. But in the last year, they have done some incredible work against ISIS, which is kind of a whole separate part of the conflict that Americans don't really think of as much in Afghanistan. But in just a year's time, they've taken almost all of ISIS's territory away from them and made a real contribution to the safety of that country.
Speaking of the Taliban, actually, President Trump also visited Afghanistan over the Thanksgiving holiday. And while he was there, he announced that peace talks with the Taliban were back on, which surprised Afghan and Taliban officials who said that was not the case and they were confused by his announcement. Based on what you heard during this trip, has anything changed during the Trump administration?
I think that people believe that in the last 2 or 3 years, we have inflicted more and more casualties on the Taliban, which has made them more willing to negotiate. I heard that last year when I was there, and I heard it again this year. And so that's something that people think has changed under this administration for sure. I think more just because of the passage of time. But they seem to believe that is what makes the Taliban willing to talk, whereas in years past, they weren't as interested in that. I don't know if that answers your question.
Sure. But I guess I'm curious what you make of the president's remarks when it comes to peace talks with the Taliban, when it comes to a ceasefire. What do you make of his remarks?
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's kind of two different things there, right? The talks are one thing and the ceasefire is another. And I think the surprise that you remarked on had a little bit more to do with his talk about the ceasefire, because, you know, that is something that the Taliban have never really successfully agreed to. And so I don't think people there are really optimistic that that's going to be part of this. But I do think a lot of folks serving us in Afghanistan believe that talks should be taking place. We've been at war for way too long. It is a stalemate. And so we have to be talking to try to end this. And we think that that process can be done and bring the troop level down while still keeping America safe.
I do want to keep this conversation focused on the military, but pivot a little bit. You have successfully prosecuted cases of military misconduct. I'm curious what you make of the president intervening in cases recently in which service members were accused or convicted of war crimes and pardoning them for their conduct. What do you make of those pardons, and do you approve of them?
I think it's deeply concerning that the military members and civilian heads of those departments themselves were in such deep disagreement with the president, and that you had Navy SEALs themselves saying this was a situation where he had broken faith with what the Navy SEALs were really supposed to be about. And look, it's, you can't ignore the fact that the president seems to be making this a political issue and a political decision instead of one that's about the facts and the laws and the moral standards that bind the U.S. military. So I'm very concerned about it. Each one of the cases involved is very different, so I think it's important that we not just address these things as a political matter. But at the end of the day, one of the things that this is showing the American people is that the president does have pardon authority. It's legal what he did, whether you like it or not. And so, you know, that might be something we have to think about going forward, about whether we want to take another look at those laws and the options that are available to him. But I think the important thing is that we continue to administer military justice in a fair in a predictable way so that military commanders and people with experience can make the decisions about these cases.
That was 90.5 WESA's Lucy Perkins speaking with Democratic Congressman Connor Lamb, who represents Allegheny County suburbs and Beaver County. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. About 2 miles down the Ohio River from where the Monongahela and Allegheny Rivers meet, there's an unassuming island with a storied past. For our Good Question series, 90.5 WESA's Katie Blackley reports on the history of Bruno Island.
Pittsburgh resident Scott Cooper often passes the island on nearby roads.
I always see it kind of in the middle of the Ohio River near the city of Pittsburgh, and I've always wondered, like, what's the significance of it? Has anything significant happened there?
This is Bruno Island. Unlike many of its Pittsburgh Island cousins, no one lives here, and it's not accessible by car. So, WESA editor Chris Potter and I hopped in a canoe and launched into the water from the north side.
We are about halfway across the main channel on the mighty Ohio River. See it, but we're not too close to it.
Overgrown grass carpets the banks of Bruno Island, and driftwood thuds against remnants of old steel slabs and no trespassing signs. In the distance, electrical towers loom over the tallest trees, connected by dozens of wires.
Just to our right is the West End Bridge, and slightly behind us is the Alcasand plant and the former SCI Pittsburgh.
The 129-acre island lies between West End communities like Esplin and McKees Rocks and the north side's Marshall Shadeland neighborhood. It's about the same elevation as the banks of the Ohio surrounding it. It can be seen from highways 65 and 51. French doctor Felix Bruno built a home on this kidney bean-shaped island in the 1790s. Bruno was the foster brother of Revolutionary War General Lafayette and accompanied him to Pittsburgh. On the island, Bruno and his family entertained some notable guests, according to John McNulty with the Lewis and Clark Heritage Trail Foundation.
And he was the owner of it in 1803 when Captain Meriwether Lewis was launching his boat from Fort Fayette, which is the present site of Pittsburgh's downtown David Lord's Convention Center.
The Lewis and Clark Heritage Trail begins downtown and passes by Bruno Island. Lewis was invited by Bruno to stop by his residence when he first embarked on his famous journey to explore the West. The Bruno family maintained a residence there until about 1819, when they left and the land was used for farming. Around the turn of the 20th century, George Westinghouse's Pittsburgh Railways Company bought the island and built an electric generating station.
This is just when electricity, when a light bulb was getting invented.
Pat Conti is with the Duquesne Light Company, which took over the generating station a few years later. Its operations occupied one side of the island, and on the other, a recreational facility was established.
There's a group of Pittsburgh businessmen. They call themselves the Pittsburgh and Allegheny Driving Club. And I guess they needed a place to have fun on the weekend, so they built the one-mile oval dirt track on the island.
The Bruno Island Racetrack featured horses and automobiles transported to the island by barge or ferry. Its first races were held there in 1904, when 55 miles per hour was considered speedy. Still, the experience brought a lot of fans and well-known drivers to the island.
There was an AAA championship car race, and it was won by Lewis Chevrolet.
Lack of interest and an increased need for electricity caused the racetrack to close in 1914. By that time, Duquesne Light had expanded operations with the construction of a second power plant. The coal-fired facility supplied hundreds of thousands of kilowatts of electricity to the city. Over the years, as technology has advanced, the generating station has changed too.
And on Bruno Island today, it's not owned by Duquesne Light, the generating station. It's run by natural gas.
Conte says a visit to Bruno Island is like entering a different world. Sure, there are roads and old loading docks for barges.
But then in between all of it is all wildlife. Trees, flowers, bushes, lots and lots of birds.
The Audubon Society identified dozens of species of birds when it recently surveyed the island. When we paddled by, deer watched from the shore. The island has seen centuries of Pittsburgh history, and now most of it is quietly returning to nature. I'm Katie Blackley, 90.5 WESA News.
Good Question is a regular feature on 90.5 WESA, where we investigate what you've always wondered about Pittsburgh. Submit a question of your own at WESA.FM. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Readers look forward to a new issue of National Geographic as much for the stunning photos as for the fascinating stories of peoples and cultures around the world. A new exhibit, National Geographic 50 Greatest Wildlife Photographs, just opened at the Carnegie Museum of Natural History, and Museum Director Eric Dorfman is here to tell us all about it. Welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
All right. So 50.
Yes.
As a curator yourself, how difficult do you imagine it was to limit this collection, this traveling collection, to just 50 photos from across the globe?
Oh, it would have been incredibly difficult. I'm glad it wasn't my job to do, but they did do a fantastic job. And I think their perspective really was not just a beautiful photograph, but something that tells a story that gives an insight into the private world of animals that most people don't get to see. So I think it's exciting just as much for the story that each one tells as the visuals.
So if you had the space to accommodate, how many would you have liked to see?
Oh, 500? Yeah, that's it. It uses our largest gallery, Simmons Gallery, mm-hmm. and it is full. It's really such a superb show. But you know, obviously at some point too, you want a chance to view each one and reflect. So we haven't crammed it full. It's still a very nice, peaceful environment. It's very dark. So the photos themselves really come to the fore and they have a lot of presence. Mm-hmm.
The photos that I've seen represent a mix of creatures on land, in the sea, and in the air.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. We've got beautiful photos of birds flying through lightning strikes. There's deep sea creatures that really look like they're from outer space. And this beautiful one of a panda that's just, it almost looks like a family portrait. It's so beautiful, very elegant. And as much as possible, the photographers have worked to show you the environment of the animals as well. And they are really, I said the word portrait, they are really, some of them especially, are just stunningly beautiful. You really feel like you're looking into the soul of the animal. It's really incredible.
You talked about stories, and it's, of course, a mix of habitats as well.
That's right. And from all over the world. So Every continent is represented. There's the tropics, the deep ocean, the Arctic. There's snow. There's foliage. There's sand. It's just a real mix of different sorts of habitats. And because they're all large format, you can see them really up close. And some of them actually we've replicated into wall size too. So there's the chance to get right in there and feel that you're with the animals.
Do you feel that this exhibit is both sort of artistic and scientific?
Absolutely. And you know, that's really one of the things that we try to do is mix the science, the hard knowledge that we create as a natural history institution with the artistry that connects people on an emotional level. So we're sort of looking at hearts and minds, if you like.
Mm-hmm. All right. I have my favorites.
Oh, yes.
But first, you. Do you have a favorite of the 50?
You know, it's so hard to pick. There are so many.
I'm going to force you.
So, well, you really, so one thing I will say, so I did a postdoc in South Africa working with wildlife. Water birds were what I was working on, but I lived near a nature reserve, and there's one here of a giraffe walking through the mist. And I will say, when I saw giraffes in the wild for the first time, it was such an incredible life-changing event for me. They're so big, just impossibly big. And we have this one, this photograph of giraffe walking through the mist, looking into the camera. And that, to me, is just so, it reminds me so much of that experience that even though I love them all, I really right. do, this one has a special meaning for me personally.
Oh, special me. Well, that's one of my favorites of the ones I've seen. I've always been a fan of giraffes, but I really like this one because we could have seen a giraffe on us running in sunshine or something like that. But the fact that it's walking through the mist is very different.
It has this sort of sense of mystery, doesn't it? And it's just been captured so beautifully. Mm-hmm. You wonder. I mean, this is always when I look at these photos. You know, we see the finished product of hours and hours of sitting there in the cold and the damp or the underwater or whatever it is, trying to capture that right moment, because I mean, there's so much skill as a photographer, but there's a lot of luck too. And the longer you're out there, the longer you're going to see that particular behavior that captures the moment and the sort of the spirit of the animal.
Luck, patience.
Oh, lots and lots of patience. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Our guest on The Confluence is Eric Dorfman. He is the director of the Carnegie Museum of Natural History, and we're talking about the new exhibit, National Geographic 50 Greatest Wildlife Photos. I want to mention a few of the others.
Absolutely.
Because we can't talk about all 50. There's a great photo of spinner dolphins off of Oahu, Hawaii. The name seems to say it all. Spinner dolphins.
That's right. And they actually do have that behavior where they will jump out of the water and spin, which is a characteristic of this species. And they're absolutely beautiful. And of course, the water there is so clear. You can see the whole pod swimming together. And it's just absolutely magnificent.
Another one I wanted to mention, of course, my other favorite is, and you know, I think this would rank up there with a lot of people's favorites, the giant panda.
Oh yes,
that is
stunning.
This is from a reserve in China,
and it's, you know, there's so many ways to look at this picture. For one thing, just aesthetically, this panda's, can I call him majestic? He's just got this presence, right? He's sitting, looking into the camera. And he in a pile of leaves, actually, with the mist all around him, and it's just so tranquil, but also has such presence. And so on that level, it's an incredible feast visually, but also, you know, pandas are really threatened. There is so much work that needs to be done in to conserve them. And to see a panda like this in the wild, even though it's on a reserve, isn't the way we normally see them nowadays. You know, we're used to them in surrounded by concrete, being fed bamboo out of a bowl.
Right.
And this is capturing something that most people will never get the opportunity to witness. And it's really, really special from that perspective as well.
There's a photo that I sort of drew back from. It's like, uh-oh, what is this doing? I see a hand in the water.
Oh, yes, that one. That is
fantastic.
And
they're actually trying to pet a whale.
Yes, I know. This gorgeous baby gray whale in California. And, you know, they are very inquisitive, especially baby whales. You know, because they're so big, we don't tend to think of them as being inquisitive, but they have all of the curiosity that lots of baby animals have. And this is really adorable. I'm imagining that the whale seconds later actually is nuzzling up against the people. And, you know, again, thinking about my personal background, I learned to scuba dive in Monterey Bay, which is an absolute fantastic place to learn because the animals are so friendly there. So otters and seals and whales are very, you can get very close. Well, they'll come to you. Mm-hmm. And that's the important part. It's important never to go up to a marine mammal, but just let them approach you if that's going to happen.
Right.
But this one, just for me also, at the museum, we are really focused on the relationship between humans and nature and wanting to break down the barriers of us versus them and help people understand that we're part of nature just as much as any other sort of creature is. And this, to me, is a wonderful kind of, it captures that possibility in a way that few pictures could. And that's very special to me.
And that juxtaposes the size. Here you have a baby whale that takes up the vast majority of the photo itself. And then you have this forearm and hand dangling in the water.
I know. And it's wonderful. And I just love that waiting, that sense of waiting, that the person is there and the baby's approaching, and it's just a fabulous just little moment there, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Eric, how does this exhibit complement the well-known collections that the Carnegie Museum has there all the time for people to enjoy?
Well, we have 22 million objects featuring almost every major taxonomic group there is, and we've been collecting for 125 years. So it's a really big, it's a vast collection. And people come to know us for the variety of stories we can tell. So we have exhibitions. Well, we've got wildlife halls, dinosaurs, we've got minerals, all these different things are telling a story of the vast diversity of life that's out there. And what this does to me, this 50 greatest photographs, it's almost a microcosm of the different stories that we tell as a museum. So it's showing on display the vast wealth of things that are out there. But also, like I said before, it allows you to connect on an emotional level, which is also what we try to do with every story we tell.
So how long will we reside at the Carnegie Museum of Natural History?
It closes May 25th.
All right. What would you like the visitors to come away with after viewing this exhibit beyond appreciating some stunning photos?
So many of the habitats that are shown in these variety of photographs are under threat. There's habitat degradation, obviously changing climate, species lost from invasive species of other types. And there are many opportunities out there to get involved and to protect the wildlife we have left. And if people can feel inspired to become personally involved in saving some of those habitats and that wildlife that are portrayed in these photos, that would be for me a huge success.
Eric Dorfman is the museum director for the Carnegie Museum of Natural History. Its latest exhibit, National Geographic 50 Greatest Wildlife Photographs, is open now. Eric, thanks so much for dropping by.
Thank you for having me.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, after a two-year search, the Carnegie Museums of Pittsburgh have named a new leader. What about that sweeping gig was enough to draw Washingtonian Stephen Knapp out of semi-retirement? Plus, what a collaborative reporting project hopes to teach us about the good Ohio River. If you missed anything from today's program, or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Assistance from Julia Zenkovich. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.